From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, a teacher caught in a sexual relationship with a 14-year-old girl is sent to prison. In civil court, the girl is responsible.
At least as far as civil law goes, there is no age of consent in California.
Also, imagine hearing this on your first day as president.
Basically, there is no really coherent, organized system in the U.S. government for how we're going to defend the internet.
How the U.S. has been preparing for cyber warfare. Plus, writer Megan Down tries to come up with a new term for middle-aged.
Are we in the twilight of youth? That sounds almost worse. That sounds not good.
And Melvin Van Peebles gets funky with an intergalactic love story.
It was phenomenal. It was great. I haven't had so much fun with clothes on in years.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Our first story today deals with young people and sexual predators. If there are any young people you'd like to shield from this report, come back to us in about 6 minutes. Now, protecting young people from sexual predators would seem to be a universally held value in this country. No state has an age of consent lower than 16. But in some courtrooms, attorneys argue that children can make decisions about who they have sex with. And in some cases, those attorneys are winning. We begin with a case here in California. In 2010, a 28-year-old middle school math teacher began a 6-month sexual relationship with a 14-year-old female student at his school. The teacher was convicted in criminal court of lewd acts with a child, and he went to prison. The girl's family then sued the L.A. Unified School District in a civil case. Investigative reporter Karen Fauché pored over court documents and looked at the school district's line of defense. This past week, she broke the story for member station KPCC. Fauché was amazed at how the school district defended itself in court.
Number one, they said, we're not negligent here. We didn't know about this. There's no proof that we knew this was happening. Number two, you consented to this. You voluntarily had sex with your teacher.
And you talked with Keith Wyatt. He was a lawyer representing L.A. Unified School District.
You know, I did. He was the trial attorney in the case. And what I found very interesting is he over and over in the trial said she was at fault for this. Here's a little bit about what he said about that to me.
Why is it her fault that she planned on having sex with her teacher, that she lied to her mother so she could have an opportunity to have sex with her teacher, that she went to a motel in which she engaged in voluntary consensual sex with her teacher? Why shouldn't she be responsible for that?
When people hear this tape, parent or not parent, your jaw just drops. It's kind of amazing. Now, my understanding was always that if you're below the age of consent, you can't consent.
You know, you're right. In California, under criminal law, you have to be 18 to consent. That's the age of consent. But the civil law in California seems to back up Mr. Wyatt. There have been two rulings in California that say, wait a minute, on the civil side, minors can consent. So you can be a victim in the criminal case, but you can actually be found at fault in the civil case.
So how was the school district's trial attorney able to convince the jury?
Well, one of the things I had a question for Mr. Wyatt was, does a 13-year-old or 14-year-old have the maturity to actually make this decision?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, absolutely. And here's what he said about that.
Children make decisions all the time, all right? Making the decision whether or not to cross the street when traffic is coming, that takes a certain level of maturity, all right? And that's a much more dangerous decision than deciding, hey, I want to have sex with my teacher.
Again, that's talking about a child. He was able to successfully argue that LA Unified had no negligence in this case, no knowledge of this situation.
Karen Fauché is an investigative reporter with KPCC here in Los Angeles. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The decision in that civil case, by the way, is currently under appeal. Attorney Keith Wyatt has since issued an apology for what he called his insensitive comments. And LA Unified announced they're removing Wyatt from other legal matters before the school district because of his comments to Karen Fauché. Their statement read, in part, respect and empathy must be at the core of how we approach these cases, and Mr. Wyatt's remarks did not reflect that commitment. But LA Unified told KPCC that Wyatt's firm, Ivy McNeil and Wyatt, will continue to represent the school district in 18 lawsuits. Jennifer Drobak teaches juvenile law and sexual harassment law at Indiana University. She says what happened in California isn't unique.
There are 12 other states and perhaps more where I've documented that civil law is diverting from the criminal law treatment of adolescent and juvenile consent, such that you get the same facts, same actors, and same consent will be treated with diametrically opposite results under the law. New York has a similar problem. Out of a 1933 case, which said that a young woman who was riding a bus who consented to sex could not sue because she had consented.
How old was she?
She was either 15 or 16. But you see cases like this arising in Illinois, Maryland, Louisiana. Louisiana has a case where a 13-year-old mentally challenged student was found comparatively negligent in a case. And, you know, that kind of situation is just mind-boggling. It's shocking. That is truly a blame the victim.
Wow. Why is there, in the first place, this disparity between the age of consent when it comes to criminal law and a difference when it comes to civil law?
Well, it all got started with the California legislature in 1970. And what they did was they thought that the penalties should be different for people who engage in forcible rape versus those who have sex with juveniles where there is arguably some acquiescence. But when a child consents, we understand that in most circumstances, a child does not have what we call legal capacity, therefore no legal consent happens. But what's happened is that when the California legislature changed the law and took sex with a minor out of the forcible rape statute, and the California Supreme Court interpreted that as the legislature saying, well, juveniles may be able to consent in certain circumstances. And there's no basement on this. You could take a 9-year-old and say that a 9-year-old could consent under this reading of the change of law in California.
Is this something that needs to be settled at the federal level? Could it be?
Well, criminal law tends to be state-driven law, and the federal government has a hard time intervening unless there are national implications. So it has to be on a state-by-state basis. But I think it's possible for state lawmakers to look at this issue because I think it's an important one. Legislators have the ability to look at their laws to see if they're consistent and at the very least make the age of consent rational.
Jennifer Drobak teaches at Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. Professor Drobak, it's hard to get your head around this stuff. Thank you so much for talking this through with us.
I'm happy to do so anytime.
Across the Pacific Ocean, a small country, an American ally has provoked a big adversary. We'll call them Red, but it's impossible not to think of Red as China. Red responds aggressively, and before long, they've crippled the small country's power grid, communications networks, and other infrastructure through cyber warfare. And it launches a preemptive cyber attack against the small country's big ally, the United States. How does the U.S. military respond? That was the scenario faced by a group of high-ranking officers huddled together at an Air Force base in Colorado during a classified war game in May 2010.
It was a really instructive and, I think, very scary wargaming exercise for people in the military. This was something called the Schriever War Game.
That's Shane Harris. He wrote about the 2010 Schriever War Game in his new book called At War: The Rise of the Military Internet Complex.
And what happened was the adversary in this game really got the advantage very quickly and won pretty decisively because the American side really hadn't developed a playbook for how you would go to war between two large militaries in cyberspace. So because of that, the military started becoming much more organized and sophisticated in how it organizes its cyber forces. And today what you see is each of the military services setting up their own sort of cyber warrior components that will eventually be trained to fight alongside conventional forces so that a repeat of that war game where we were caught really flat-footed and knocked back isn't repeated.
Your book traces the rise of this military internet complex
over the course of both the George W. Bush presidency and President Obama. Imagine I'm President Obama being sworn in. Can you run through the litany of problems with cyber defense he's presented with right away?
Sure. And in fact, he actually got a little bit of a taste of this on the campaign because his campaign email system was hacked, presumably by spies in China. When he comes in on the first day, what he's presented with is the knowledge that the computers that control portions of the electrical power grid in the United States have been probed by foreign intelligence agencies. He is told that espionage, particularly by China against American corporations, is rampant and that billions of dollars in intellectual property and in trade secrets are being lost every year. And that basically there is no really coherent, organized system in the U.S. government for how we're going to defend the internet, how we're going to defend cyberspace and all of the businesses and the people that depend on it. What he decides to do very early on in the administration is to, in his words, start treating cyberspace as a national asset, a strategic asset, and protecting it as such.
Let's talk about China, because with this new U.S. Cyber Warfare Command, that seems like that's the main imagined adversary. Can you run through what China's cyber warfare capabilities are, or at least what we know of them, and how they stack up against what the U.S. can do?
The thing that China has going for it that we do not have is people, the number of people within the People's Liberation Army, within the sort of the intelligence apparatus of China, which is a very, you know, opaque system in its own right. Is believed to be thousands of people who are basically hired hackers who spend much of their day aggressively trying to penetrate the computer networks of U.S. corporations especially. China's sort of gathering information that they can then pass on to Chinese businesses and corporations that give them a leg up in negotiations and in the global marketplace. They're trying to advance their economy very quickly and stealing information to do it. Less clear is how sophisticated their sort of military offensive apparatus is compared to ours. For instance, if China ever went to war with us in the South China Sea, let's say, how sophisticated and how good would their hackers be trying to break into our naval systems and confuse our ships? We know less about that, but I think the conclusion we have to reach is that because they have so many more people doing this than we do, I mean, we have a few thousand, that China is a really formidable force. And that makes a lot of sense that they would put so many resources in this. China will never be able to, at least in the near future, challenge us in a conventional military way. They can't go head-to-head with us on land or on the sea. Cyber is a place where they can gain an extraordinary advantage and do a lot of damage.
In terms of intentions and actions, though, you know, going by what President Obama has said in terms of about cyber attacks, it sounds like the U.S. is more of the victim here in terms of the government and corporations that are being targeted by these Chinese hackers. I'm just wondering, from having studied both sides of this, is that the case or is this more of just part of the game? How much does this go both ways?
I think it goes both ways. And in fact, I say this in the book that, you know, the United States government loves to come out and talk about how relentlessly we're being hacked and how our intellectual property is being stolen from our businesses. And that's true. But what that covers up is that we are also one of the most aggressive countries going out there, breaking into other countries' systems and spying on them. And we are one of the few countries that we know of that has launched offensive operations in cyberspace. We have used computer viruses to break infrastructure, physical things that are connected to computer networks. Very few countries are known to have done that. I think one of the reasons why U.S. officials have been so keen on showing how we're victimized is because they believe that U.S. businesses have not done enough to secure their own computer networks. From the government's perspective, they can't go in and necessarily force those companies, at least not yet, to improve their defenses. So it's been sort of more of a strategic kind of rhetorical calculation on the part of the government to come out and say, we're victimized, it's terrible, lots of information is being stolen, and the only way we can stop this is you corporations have to do better security and work with us and let us help you do that. So there's a reason why the U.S. has tried to play that victim card so repeatedly. It's because they want to get results from private businesses.
That's Shane Harris. His new book is called At War, and it's out now. Shane, thank you.
You're welcome, Maroon. Thanks for having me.
Jewish girls go through the bat mitzvah. 15-year-old Latina celebrate with a quinceañera. And for generations of Indian American girls, the culmination of years of studying classical Indian dance is a lavish solo performance before a crowd of hundreds. Reporter Arun Venugopal of member station WNYC attended what may have been the first such performance by a woman with Down syndrome.
There is a word for the graduation performance in Indian cultural circles. It's called an arangetram, which literally means ascending the stage. It is a major accomplishment, the moment when a student of dance or music asserts their artistic independence, often in their teens.
I feel actually so happy in dancing.
Hema Ramaswamy of Middletown, New Jersey is 23, and today is her arangetram. Arangetrams are formative events and the stuff of successful college applications. Hema's dad, Ram, says she started dancing for health reasons.
But then it became part of her, and she really loves and enjoys it. And now it took her 13 years with a lot of challenges in the midway to complete this. And now today is a perfect day for her graduating in this art.
Despite her Down syndrome, as well as two major surgeries for a dangerous leak of cerebral spine fluid, Ram said dance has strengthened Hema's previously weak muscles and provided her with fine motor skills she simply didn't have before. With about an hour to showtime, Hema is in her dressing room, adorned in a blue silk outfit, gold chains, and bangles.
Yeah, this is better.
Getting fussed over by mom and an army of Indian aunties. Posing for pictures and getting a little sassy.
Enough, Preston.
Yes, please, Preston. Stop for a few minutes. Take a break.
Out front, a crowd files into the hall. Women in silk saris with jasmine in their hair. Lots of little kids. Old men being helped to their seats. All here to witness this unprecedented event. Hema takes her place just off stage, behind the curtain, with three friends, girls who've completed their arangetrams. They ply her with Gatorade, tell her she's beautiful, and whisper advice in her ears.
Keep your chin up. Chin up, big smile, so much expression.
And then she walks out. And for the next 2.5 hours, Hema dances. 10 dances in all, including one about the god Krishna as a baby who starts devouring mud. Dancers usually try to mimic baby Krishna, but Hema becomes him. And then she pivots into the role of Krishna's angry mother, who discovers her filthy son and orders him to open his mouth. But instead of finding mud, she finds planets, stars, galaxies, an entire unknown cosmos lying within. This is the dance, as performed by Hema Ramaswamy, that brings the audience to tears.
Awesome! Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for coming and supporting me. I'm feeling so happy. Please enjoy your rest of the evening. Thank you so much.
Hema's father tells the crowd that Hema's arangetram was more than a dance graduation, that it was, in fact, her ascent into personhood, the day she became, in the eyes of the world, a full individual. Having achieved this goal, Hema says she now plans to go to college. For NPR News, I'm Arun Venugopal.
John Steinbeck. What is there left to say about the great American writer who gave us The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men, so much great work? Well, it turns out Steinbeck himself has something left to say, thanks to an exciting discovery more than 40 years after his death. It's a short story about an African-American pilot returning to his small town in the South during World War II, and before this month, it had never been published. The story is called With Your Wings, and Andrew Gooley is the man who found it. He's the editor of The Strand magazine, a quarterly mystery magazine based in Michigan. He joins me now at NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Arun. Good to be with you.
How did you find this? How did it get lost?
From speaking to several scholars, from speaking to a lot of his biographers, it seemed that this was something that was impossible to find. And I did a lot of research in various libraries which had Steinbeck manuscripts. And at each turn, I was met with a dead end. So I finally went to the Ransom Library at the University of Texas. And I found this little short story. And it was so well done that I said to myself, this had to be published. But I finally found out it was not published. And that was it. I called the estate and I immediately made an offer.
And it must be difficult to confirm something hasn't been published, right? Because given how much is out there, how do you rule that out?
It's not easy at all. I mean, with Steinbeck, it was difficult, but not as difficult as it was for somebody like H.G. Wells, because he published in his lifetime 10,000 pages worth of works. But it's always very, very, very difficult. The nightmare of an editor is to always wake up and find out that you've called something unpublished only to find that it has been published before.
So we're talking about one of America's greatest writers, John Steinbeck. I have to think that American universities must be lousy with Steinbeck scholars. How is it you, Andrew, can come and waltz in and find this?
I feel like I'm in this never-ending dream for the past 5 years. I'll tell you that for every success, there have been 7 times where I've chased a dead lead, gotten no permission from an estate to publish this, or found out that something that looked like a wonderful gem was published in the small paper like the Boise State Register.
And you mentioned there are several other great writers who you found unpublished manuscripts for. How do you decide which authors you're going after?
It has to be something where I think that the audience would benefit and would find to be interesting. What I love about this is that it's giving me a chance to have the Strand take some writers and bring them back into the national consciousness. A lot of times we look at a writer like Steinbeck and he conjures up an image of your required reading in school.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of look at this as something to try to show the world today that these writers are very relevant, that they'll still be in the consciousness of the reading public.
You know, it also makes me a little bit wistful because we do so much reporting about data mining and discoveries that are made through vast amounts of electronic data. To think of you like going from library to library and actually going through papers and collections, I'm kind of nostalgic for that.
The great writers that we have today, they have something that has not been published before, chances are they'll just press the delete button on their computer and it'll be gone forever. I always get a wonderful kick out of going into a library or getting some of the work sent to me and saying to myself, my God, this is really great, because in many respects, his words will never die.
Andrew Gooley is the editor of The Strand magazine. Andrew, congratulations on your discovery, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Arun. Great talking to you.
Okay, Brian Ferry's recording career in 60 seconds.
There's a new sensation.
It started in 1972 with the art rock jolt of Roxy Music.
To the Strand,
their sound developed a glossier sheen as they rounded the corner into the 1980s.
Love is the dark of you, more than there.
And that gave way to Ferry's solo career as more of a crooner, perpetually sporting perfect hair and bespoke suits.
Kiss and tell, let the love.
And coming this week, his first collection of new music in 4 years, Avonmore. Brian Ferry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So when it comes to Brian Ferry music, a lot of reviewers talk about how smooth it is, you know, suave, lush, sophisticated. But I hear funk in there, too. And Avonmore is, you know, it's a funky record. A lot of your records
are. That's
good
to hear.
Does that come from the musicians you work with, or do you consider yourself kind of a funky songwriter?
Well, I'd like to think I was. I've listened to a lot of pretty funky music in my time, and I was just thinking earlier about the time I hitchhiked from Newcastle in the north of England down to London to see Otis Redding play with the Stax Roadshow, and that was one of the funkiest experiences I've ever had, and it was a kind of, you know, life-changing moment, really, seeing that band.
You have your son, Tara, playing drums on this album with you. How old is he?
He's 24 now. And he really came of age on this record, though, and he's brought a lot of youthful energy to the project, actually, which is great.
I'm very curious about what it's like playing with your son as both of you are adults. I mean, do you get to know him in a different way?
I suppose so, yes, yeah, and I guess he stands up to me more than the other musicians do.
Drummer has to.
Yeah, that's right. And I tend to listen to him quite a lot, so that's rather good. Even though I am sort of set in my ways, I do listen to him. And it's good to have, a combination of experience and this youthful excitement about recording, which him and some of the other young players I've got around me have as well.
It looks like from your touring band that you feature quite a few women among your musicians, and sometimes it feels like the music business, at least when it comes to instrumentalists, you know, I think of you and Prince, and I can't think of a lot of others. Is it a conscious choice that you make, or it just happen? No big deal.
Well, it's nice to have girls in the band, that's for sure. It makes for a much better atmosphere. Actually, I saw Prince playing in London in this small venue. He did a surprise show one night, and he's got an all-girl band. And
Third Eye Girl, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. They're great players. And they're the only people who've worked in my studio, apart from me, actually. But the girls in my band, one or two of them have been there for a while.
With your band, though, was it something, did you say, I'm going to have more gender diversity in this group, or were these just the best musicians?
Not really. Georgia came along, and I think she auditioned together with the guys, and she won the job, and she was fantastic. And then similarly, the drummer we have on tour at the moment, Charisse, she's a really good player. She got the job over a couple of other guys. So, yeah, and we have a fair competition.
I'm speaking with Brian Ferry about his new album. It's called Avonmore. You're somebody who has taken great pleasure, it seems, in covering classics. I think pretty much as soon as you were on the scene.
Yeah.
Still, I wasn't quite ready for your version of Send in the Clouds.
I think it has a really haunting lyric, and I've always liked that song. I heard it years ago done by Sinatra, and it's good to take a song that's had a life in a musical. Some of the great pop songs were written for musicals. You know, Cole Porter used to write for musicals, and it's good to take a song from that world and put it into my world, I guess. Where are the clouds?
Brian, I want to talk about your appearance.
Okay.
You always look. This is something that people talk about, like with your sound. Like, you're smooth. You always look quite dapper. I can't imagine you ever dressed down. Do you have that Miles Davis philosophy of you always got to look clean?
Exactly. He was one of my great heroes, one of the idols I had growing up, and him and Charlie Parker, both kind of very cool dressers, very sharp, and in fact all those bebop players were, all the jazz guys used to kind of suits and ties, and they always looked really cool, I thought. Got to try and live up to their standard.
And your background's kind of working class, right? You didn't dress for dinner in your family, did you?
Oh, no, we didn't, no. No, we fought for scraps. Yeah, and that my parents were very keen that I should get on in the world, you know, and go to university and stuff, which I did. They always felt that there was a better world out there for us, which there turned out to be.
That's Brian Ferry. His new album comes out on Tuesday. It's called Avonmore. Brian Ferry, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
People have been predicting the fusion of technology and fashion for decades, but that day is finally here. Google Glass and other wearable tech like smart wristbands are now part of the human landscape, and Silicon Valley companies are experimenting with new ways to integrate tech into clothing and jewelry. Of course, early adopters always face problems. Things don't work quite right, or things don't fit quite right. But in the case of wearables, critics say a big part of the problem is that the design teams are not diverse enough, that most wearables are designed by men with men in mind. Isabel Olson, the lead designer of Google Glass, says that's why she's encouraging more women to enter the tech industry as developers and designers. When she first joined the team, Google Glass looked very different from what we see on the street today.
I saw a very early prototype of glass that the engineers were wearing, and it was kind of like safety goggles with a phone attached to it with cables running off of it, and it was a pretty scary sight, I have to say.
When you came onto this, what exactly did Google ask you to do?
It was pretty straightforward, actually. They showed me this clunky prototype, and they asked me to make it beautiful and comfortable. One piece is making sure to pack all the technology, really, to make it a lot smaller. But that wasn't the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge was, how do you make something people want to wear? And how can we create something that people can really make their own? Which is, for wearables in general, one of the most important aspects.
Can you tell us about who's on your team, like their backgrounds?
I try to have a very gender diverse team, so we're about 50-50, men and women, and I think that's a really, really important aspect.
That kind of diversity is not really present in a lot of the tech industry. You know, it's a big criticism of the tech industry. Is there a problem in that maybe there needs to be more diversity on the other end of the design?
I think that's something that I'm personally really passionate about, trying to kind of change that. I see slow changes and I see a lot of movement behind this. And I think more and more people understand how the context of where you're designing or developing a product really affects the end result.
You know, it makes me wonder, talking about both ends of design here, that when we think about things like computers or phones, we think of them as unisex. Given the scarcity of women in technology, are those gadgets really unisex, or do they reflect a male bias in design?
I do think the designs are a reflection of the team that created them. So in many cases, it happens to be a very male-skewed object that comes out in the end. So I think unless we solve the gender balance in the teams that are developing these things, we're not going to see a solution.
Clearly, we're at the beginning of wearable technology. Where do you see this headed? Do you think we're going to be at a point where technology and fashion are difficult to separate?
I think that wearable technology is actually one of the most natural ways to use technology. So if you think about it for a second, with glass, for example, it's really close to your senses. It's close to your mouth, to your hearing, to your vision. And placing technology there has the potential of making it a much more natural interaction. And I think that's the premise. I think right now, technology kind of gets in our way. And that's where wearable technology has the most potential to be in our lives, to be there for us, but not in the way.
Isabel Olson is the lead designer of Google Glass. Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles Lakers have played just 9 games so far, but it's already their worst start ever. They're just 1-8. There is one thing, though, the Lakers are doing right, and that's winning Latino fans. The media research company Nielsen says 12% of the NBA's overall fan base is Hispanic. But according to the website 538, the Lakers have almost doubled that. NPR's Becky Sullivan has the story.
Before tip-off at the Staples Center, the Lakers' home court in downtown Los Angeles, the lights are bright and the music is loud. More than half of the 30 NBA teams broadcast at least some of their games in Spanish, but they're radio only. Only the Lakers have a dedicated TV broadcast crew and channel all about the Lakers, all in Spanish. And it is the real deal.
Our pregame, talk to the producer, and then we're up for pregame Lakers and Mule.
This is Adrian Garcia Marquez, La Voz de los Lakers. We're standing courtside near the basket, next to a full-blown camera and lights setup. This is the third season where Garcia Marquez and color commentator Francisco Pinto have gotten to call almost every Lakers game. A few minutes later, the teams are on the court, ready for tip-off, and Garcia Marquez goes on.
Jordan Hill y ahora Jeremy avanzando el ataque de los Lakers. La primera llega la púrpura y oro de la noche.
In 2011, the Lakers signed a deal with Time Warner Cable, the first of its kind. It set up two TV channels for Lakers games instead of just one. Along with the English language Sportsnet, there'd also be the Spanish language Time Warner Cable Deportes. They immediately hired Adrian Garcia Marquez. He grew up in San Diego, the American-born kid of Mexican immigrants.
My dad was kind of strict with habla español, you know, speak Spanish. But we were allowed to say Padres and Chargers, even though Padres technically is a word in español, Padres, right? But, you know, Padres, Chargers, sports stuff, we could speak in English.
The result is a Spanish language broadcast that is clearly bicultural. Garcia Marquez uses words like jumpercito, a little jump shot, 4 or 5 feet from the basket. Or this call from the game recap on Deportes.
Kobe Bryant de Tripotitlán, sin ningún problema.
Kobe Bryant from Tripotitlán. That's a play on the phrase three-point land and Tenochtitlán, the Aztec capital where Mexico City is today. Heidi Peyurano is a Hispanic marketing expert, and she says this bicultural sound is totally on purpose. She says a lot of companies make a mistake when they say, let's reach out to Hispanics. There's no nuance. But basketball's efforts are more targeted.
The NBA really did a lot of homework and research and hone in that their sweet spot was going to be the more bicultural and acculturated Hispanic consumer.
One famous example of this bicultural marketing are those jerseys that say El Heat or Los Lakers. Some Latino fans take offense at those. They say, do you really think we wouldn't understand El Calor is the Heat or Los Lagadores are the Lakers?
A lot of companies go straight to the stereotype.
Nelson Guevara is a 23-year-old Lakers fan.
And they didn't do that. They just took the language, which is how we say Los Lakers anyways, and they ran with that.
Nelson's lived in L.A. County his whole life. He's the kid of immigrants, too. These ones from El Salvador. And he grew up speaking Spanish at home and English in school. So, in other words, he's exactly who the NBA is after. And he can tell. It feels a little weird, he says, but he's benefiting from it, too. His family used to have to listen to the games on the Spanish radio or just watch the English broadcast on mute. But now they can watch the games together, in Spanish, on Deportes. On the other hand, Nelson says, it wasn't the marketing that hooked his parents on Laker basketball. It was all the winning the team was doing when his folks immigrated back in the 70s. But now that the Lakers are so bad, he says,
I guess it's going to be interesting to see how many fans become Clipper fans now.
That's the Los Angeles Clippers. And maybe Nelson is onto something. For the first time in years, more people are going to see the Clippers at home games and away than the 16-time champs, the Lakers. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The personal essay is a tricky thing. These days, it feels like everyone is journaling their lives through blogs, Facebook, Tumblr, whatever. But quality writing with real insight about the human condition, much harder to find. Maybe that's why writer Megan Daum is so celebrated. In an era of internet exhibitionism, her explorations of why we do what we do still manage to shock. Megan Daum's new book of essays is called The Unspeakable, and she joins me here at NPR West. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I kind of felt like this is self-absorbed, but this book was sort of directed right at me because we were both born in 1970, and you write very specifically about the peculiarity of this time in your life. You're not young anymore. You're not exactly old. There's something kind of unnerving about it.
Yeah, I feel like it hasn't been defined.
I guess technically we're middle-aged. If you're in your mid-40s, you're middle-aged, but that just doesn't sound right.
Because I didn't want
people,
to say that.
People in their 60s, I know the audience, you know, people are just turning off their radios. Middle-aged people, people in their 60s are middle-aged, right? So I don't think we're quite there. It's almost like are we in the twilight of youth? That sounds almost worse. That sounds not good.
And it's not just that this is an awkward age to be, but our generation, Generation X, for lack of a better term, that's the term that stuck. You feel like we arrived at kind of an awkward time too.
Awkward, but also interesting. Here's the thing: we are actually, in my view, our sensibilities are more closely aligned with the boomers than the millennials. A lot having to do with technology. We remember a time pre-digital era. We were sentient beings during that time. We were not using the internet in junior high school. And we had junior high school and not middle school.
And there's this moment that you refer to in the book that kind of draws us into focus. It's an off-camera moment from the Today Show in 1994. And I actually want to play this for people. We'll hear Brian Gumbel, Katie Couric, and Elizabeth Vargas.
Oh, that's
that
right.
Little mark with the A and then the ring around it?
At.
See, that's what I said.
Mm-hmm.
Katie said she thought it was about.
Yeah. Oh.
But I've never heard
or
it.
Around.
I've never heard it said. I'd always seen the mark, but never heard it said. And then it sounded stupid when I said it. Violence at NBC. There it is. Violence at NBC. GE.com. I mean.
Well, Allison should know.
What is internet anyway?
What is internet anyway? Brian Gumbel's pressing question.
He might still be asking that question. Who knows? I my only regret is that we couldn't see their hairstyles and their clothing in this radio clip. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
You imagine in this book dialogues between your younger and older selves. I think it's something that a lot of people do. And I was hoping you could read a section for us. This is, you're imagining one of these conversations, but this is what your older self would hold back.
Yes. Okay. Here's what older self will not have the heart to say. Some of the music you are now listening to, the CDs you play while you stare out the window and think about the 5 million different ways your life might go, will be unbearable to listen to in 20 years. They will be unbearable not because they will sound dated and trite, but because they will sound like the lining of your soul. They will take you straight back to the place you were in when you felt that anything could happen at any time, that your life was a huge room with 1,000 doors, that your future was not only infinite, but also elastic. They will be unbearable because they will remind you that at least half of the things you once planned for your future are now in the past, and others got reabsorbed into your imagination before you could even think about acting on them. It will be as though you never thought of them in the first place, as if they were never meant to be anything more than passing thoughts you had while playing your stereo at night.
There's this tension there that I feel it kind of runs through the whole book. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you have a discomfort with sentimentality, but it's also inescapable at the same time.
Yeah, I started off thinking that really what linked these essays was sentimentality. I wrote a couple inspired by experiences that I had had personally over the last couple of years. And then I started to think about what was the theme, and the theme had to do with the way that our culture is really wedded to certain ideas about taking meaning from experiences that might not necessarily be there. The idea that you have to be redeemed after some sort of traumatic event, or you have to learn a lesson, or you have to come out a better person from a crisis.
Like when you're writing about your mother's death, you have this awareness of there's like this script that you're supposed to be following at the same time that you're going through this emotionally.
Yeah. I had a couple of years where my mother, in about an 18-month period, my mother got sick and died. And then I had a freak illness less than a year later and almost died myself. And I found in both of those situations that there was this expectation to have a kind of transformative experience. You know, we expect things of the dying that are really unreasonable.
When you had your own brush with death, people kind of came to you almost with their burdens afterwards of wanting to have like some sense of a turnaround, a conversation with Jesus or something that you would come out of it.
Yeah, and I think they were really scared, and they were really, when I started to get better, friends were saying, oh, you know, we were praying or we were thinking about this in a certain way, and we want to know what you think about it now. We want to know, is there some secret out there? And all I could really say was, you know, not really. Like, I'll probably go back to my shallow, whiny ways. And that's actually recovery, though, right? That actually is a success, I think. Staying the same person rather than becoming a different person, which is what they wanted. It was as if they couldn't believe that I had actually recovered unless I was transformed in some way.
Megan Dalm's new book of essays is called Unspeakable. Megan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Arun.
If that music takes you right back to the 1980s and a pre-Baywatch David Hasselhoff, you have Glenn Larson to thank. Larson created Knight Rider, which featured Hasselhoff foiling criminals with the help of a talking car, and he wrote that distinctive music to boot. Glenn Larson died on Friday. He was one of the most prolific TV producers in history. He created Quincy, the original Battlestar Galactica, Magnum P.I., The Fall Guy, and the list goes on, and it's truly remarkable. But, and not to disrespect the dead, Glenn Larson was never a darling among the critics. These days, most people seem to enjoy those old shows ironically, or as a guilty pleasure. The show Manimal, about a man who could change into animals, and of course use those abilities to fight evildoers, has been called the worst TV show ever. But on those terms, it's also awesome.
Dr. Jonathan Chase. Wealthy, young, handsome. A man with the brightest of futures. A man with the darkest of past.
Cynthia Littleton writes about television for Variety. She says the critics may have sneered, but they can't take away Larson's impact on popular culture.
I mean, I think the greatest influence is the fact that we can all still talk about them. And we, you know, we can all, many of us can describe Knight Rider in a sentence and The Fall Guy in a sentence. And even the shows going back to the 70s. Quincy, who hasn't zoned out watching a Quincy rerun on the weekend, you know, enjoying it? So, I mean, these are indelible shows. They may not have been Emmy bait, but these are shows that went the distance.
She also says that Larson deserves a ton of credit and respect for being able to get it done as a showrunner. By the count of The Hollywood Reporter, he's responsible for more than 500 hours of television over 21 seasons. But there's another standard critique of Glenn Larson, that many of his TV shows were ripoffs of movies. The science fiction writer Harlan Ellison famously called him Glenn Larceny. BJ and the Bear, about a trucker and his pet chimp, it was an awful lot like Any Which Way But Loose, a movie featuring Clint Eastwood as a trucker with a pet orangutan. Automan looks a lot like Tron. And that list goes on and on. Fox Pictures actually sued over Battlestar Galactica, claiming it was a Star Wars ripoff. In the end, though, Fox lost. Cynthia Littleton says that beyond all the shows, Larson leaves behind another unmistakable legacy.
What I would say is, you know, one of Larson's strengths was clearly casting. He helped launch a lot of careers. Lee Majors, Tom Selleck, David Hasselhoff. For good or ill, he had an eye for talent that was going to make an impact in the industry.
Glenn Larson passed away on Friday. He was 77 years old. A lot of popular musicians in the 60s and 70s showed a passionate interest in getting extremely high, higher than any human has ever been. I'm talking, of course, about space exploration. David Bowie, Pink Floyd, Sun Ra, Funkadelic all contributed to our shared space mythology. Not so much these days, but a new record is a welcome and trippy exception.
I guess if I was back on planet Earth, marooned on some island, back a few centuries ago, before I was even born, I guess I'd be writing all this down and stuffing it in a bottle. I guess I'd be strolling down to the beach and tossing it into the sea. But under the circumstances, ESP is the best you're gonna get out of me.
The music is from a band out of London called Heliocentrics, and the poetry is by the one and only Melvin Van Peebles, the revolutionary filmmaker who probably doesn't get his due because he gets lumped in with the blaxploitation genre. Van Peebles weaves a story that's been described as an intergalactic rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, an astronaut sending out messages while exploring deep, deep space. Messages about the sort of love you can find in the cosmos when you lower your standards a bit. like no longer holding out for carbon-based lovers. It's called The Last Transmission.
Turns out the cave wasn't just any old cavern. It was some kind of tavern. What's more, the clouds, which at first had been seen to be just swirling around, were a bunch of locals, misty, methane-based folks getting down. Well, this one, the finest lady-slash-cloud I'd ever seen.
The idea for this story came to Melvin Van Peebles years ago, back when he was in the Air Force.
I used to fly these as a navigator, radar operator, bombardier on a secret jet bomber. And it flew so high that people didn't even know it was in there for years. And I spent a lot of time up above everything. You're sitting there in another world. I mean, in really another world. And these thoughts ran through my mind a zillion times.
Van Peebles only decided to set this story to music once his producer, Eothan Allapatt, slipped him an unreleased instrumental track from this band Van Peebles had never heard of, Heliocentrics.
Melvin, you gotta hear this, you gotta do this, that really simply is what happened. Then I heard it, and I said, wow.
The sounds reminded Van Peebles of his long-forgotten galactic love story. So he wrote it up, laid down the vocals, and sent the recording to Heliocentric's founding member, Malcolm Catto.
Melvin somehow got hold of this track and done his own thing on it without us even knowing.
But Catto wanted to collaborate on more than just one song.
It started the seed, you know, of a concept to us. Why don't we make like a science fiction kind of soundtrack to go with this story?
Yeah, believe the universe. That's right. We're as happy as can be. My methane mom and me.
Heliocentric supported Van Peebles' distant love story with otherworldly sounds. Lots of oscillation and static. Like distant radio signals that just don't want to cooperate.
That's basically our idea of what it must seem like by the time it reaches another intelligence far off into space somewhere. What would it be like, this message? It'd start off and then slowly dissipate until it's light years away, and you just get all this, like, radio chatter. That's an idea that really interests us, is that somewhere, someplace, maybe all this stuff that's going on right now, this interview, and all the TV stuff that's been going since the 50s, all this information will eventually filter out through space and arrive somewhere. And what would that be like? It would be crazy, the sound that it'd make, and that's what we're trying to recreate.
Melvin Van Peebles was ecstatic about the odd partnership.
We have me here in New York, them in London, never met, but it seems I know them, what they're thinking, what I'm thinking. It was phenomenal. It was great. I haven't had so much fun with clothes on in years.
Life is about making do, which brings me back to my methane mama. What she can do to my molecules? Well, we won't go into that. Suffice it to say, there ain't no way I'm changing back.
That's Melvin Van Peebles, film director, musician, composer, actor, playwright, novelist, poet, probably a lot of other things we don't even know about or understand. Together, he and Malcolm Catto's band, Heliocentrics, have released a new album called The Last Transmission. Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs, big and small. Karen Parsons played spoiled rich girl Hilary Banks on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. But before she was rubbing shoulders with Will Smith on the hit 90s sitcom, Karen Parsons was just another struggling actress in Hollywood, working as a hostess, taking acting classes, and going on lots of auditions.
The very first thing I got, which I can't call my big break because
It was a horror film called Death Spa.
Death Spa. Welcome to the health club where you'll sweat blood.
It was a haunted gym.
It's the place for a killer workout.
And mind you, it was a big deal to me at the time, but it was also kind of, you know, like not a whole lot of people saw it. Thank goodness. When I got the audition for Fresh Prince the first time, I think it was called the Untitled Fresh Prince Project or something like that. I remember my first reactions being, oh God, it's a sitcom with a rapper. Like, what's that? You know? When I was first auditioning for Hillary, the character was written as a model type. So my first reaction to it was, oh, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to get this. I'm not a model type, you know. This is silly. And so I did what I could do, which was I kind of turned her into a little bit of a real brat.
Dad, I need $300. What dog did he steal that sweater from?
Yeah, she didn't turn out to be a model type at all. Maybe a wannabe.
I haven't been this happy since I bought my Giorgio Armani suit.
Once I got the part, I still went back to my hostessing job because I didn't know what was going to happen with that show. And I remember Will and a bunch of guys would come by and make fun of me outside the window, laugh at me. Will would say, what are you doing here? What is wrong with you? And I said, I don't know what's going to happen. So I stuck with my job, you know, keep your day job for a while. And then, of course, we got picked up. And that definitely changed everything. My favorite scene was when they found out that Hillary dropped out of college. Will finds out, and he ends up blackmailing me.
Did you memorize that little list of things I gave you to do at dinner tonight?
Yes.
Well, just to be on the safe side, let's have a little pop quiz. Anytime anyone says Hillary, what do?
I bark like a dog.
The dinner table scene was hilarious and really fun.
Hillary! 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 Hillary!
Stop it! I can't take it anymore! I dropped out of school there!
It was fun to play that girl. It was fun to just be so self-absorbed that you say just ridiculous things. That was definitely my big break. That was a life-changing moment for me, and I believe for all of us on the show. I definitely wouldn't be who I am now if I hadn't had the experience of playing Hillary Banks. I sometimes talk in Hillary's voice, but not on purpose. Often I meet people at the store or on some place in the street, and they say, you know who you look like? And then once I speak, they say, oh, it's you! I knew it because of your voice! I'm always like, no, you didn't. It wasn't my voice. I don't talk like that.
Actress Karen Parsons. Today she runs an organization called Sweet Blackberry, producing short films about unsung heroes in black history. You don't have to be the star of a 90s sitcom to have a big break. Email us your story at mybigbreak@npr.org. For the week ending November 16th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Chris Keneally, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Chloe Prasinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.